Blog Talk Radio.
Talk Radio, and the program is, of course, Masonic Companion. This is bringing, continuing the discussion that you may have had in your lodge or may have wanted to have. We can talk about some of the questions that may be more difficult to bring forward when a room is full of people that have a multitude of interests in the topic that you have in mind. And good morning to all of the, and hello, good afternoon and good evening to all of the newcomers to the show. The intent is exactly what you would imagine, to not appear like a rambling conversation by old guys, but to add some content that's useful and be a bit entertaining. And if we're not at all provocative, then we're really sort of missing the point. Not to say that the work is to irritate everybody, but it's to make us think. I had it's been an exceptional day. This is the 26th of January 2014. Now, let me do my calculations. I think that's the 26th day of the year. And we're into post-Robbie Burns celebrations around. I hope the celebration went well for you. I hope you turned your mind just briefly to the words of the Scottish poet that has lingered with us for a long, long time. And I'm going to read just one passage from Burns. This is from his Improbables. My mouth used to work, eh? No one poor stone to tell thy name or make thy virtues known, but what avails to thee, to me, the sculpture of the stone. Now, just try and keep that in mind. Keep that in mind as we go along. You'll see where, I hope you'll see where we fit that in. And I'll put Robbie aside for another couple of weeks till we can all get around to it. Now, we're coming at this show, and I'd like to pay homage to all of you with a little piece of music that my good friend Adrian DeVries helped me to appreciate when he was the Grand Director of Music for the Grand Lodge of Canada. Just a lovely, thoughtful man. Just a great, great fella. A wonderful personality, and a treat when you're sitting down listening to him talk about music. It is obvious that the man is inspired. And as Adrian and I were sitting down to dinner at a banquet in Ottawa a few years ago, wandering Ottawa, very classic, very, very sophisticated group of Masons. And they had wandering through the tables. The room was very large, and hundreds of people there, well-dressed people, as you can imagine. This was a gala event, jazz a quartet playing for us while we were sipping sparkling wines, waiting and mingling before the event. Very, very tasteful. Somebody had sharpened their pencil. Wandering through the tables was a violinist, and she was just playing different passages. And as Adrian and I were sitting there, you know, talking, we both stopped about the same time when we heard this music, and it was just remarkable violin. And not the kind of music you'd hear in the background to a dinner chatter at all. This was, for my, you know, tin ear, I guess, I would say this is sounded quite symphonic. And the woman, very graceful young woman in her 30s, I would say, came to around to our table eventually. And we asked her, we started to talk with her. Of course, Adrian was quite eager to engage. And we found out she was here. She was a student of violin in Russia and couldn't get work and came to Canada and was going to be performing for a symphony orchestra in Ottawa to see if about getting a position. And so she was playing music. We asked her, we wanted her to do pieces for us, and Adrian did ask her, and I asked her to do a piece for us that was her favorite. And this beautiful young woman, she was just, the music was just stunning. And people are, you know, slurping on their soup and eating their souffle. I asked her to do her favorite music, and she did a folk song that her mother used to sing to her when she was a little girl. And around us, I don't think there was a dry eye when she was done. It was just the most, you know, heart-rending, beautiful, beautiful expression of music and a connection with it, every single one of us. And you could see that, you know, when you see the musician that's just really into their music, this woman was very much a part of the music. So that's a little, that's the introduction of the man. That's a little anecdote about circumstances, still very striking. And when I was humming this piece, Adrian told me that this was the Fanfare of the Common Man. So I just want to set a tone, try and, you know, a little bit of a departure for 2014 as we go into our fourth year of existence here on MC. See what you think. This is... I'll be back. I'll join you. I'm listening here. It's a very, very short piece, and it's called Fanfare to the Common Man. So this time of year here in Canada, the winter has got us in a harsh grip. It's just fantastic. You know, it just lets you know you're alive, and we're in a country that's not here for if you want easy, this isn't it. This is where people stand up on both their legs and embrace the world around them. Enjoy. Thank you. How does that work? How does that work? Just, I think, just amazing. And I hope you like that. Just to perhaps help us to get into more familiar headspace, as we would say. I have no way of knowing if you're inclined to this type of music. And we'll play every so often. I'll play bits and pieces, of course, to keep us in stride and try and help us to remember some of the things that perhaps Masonry has tended to lose, that deep spiritual connection with music. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, it was part of what we did in Freemasonry. History has been kind to it, of course, and allows us, I guess, in a way, to think that if we're looking at a cross section of history instead of down on from on high and seeing it, pan out in front of us, that we begin to think that Sibelius and Mozart was pouring out of every lodge room. Well, it wasn't. We like to think that. But these were men just like you and I. So I'm on a bit of a tear here today. And I need to thank you for the ongoing support. The listenership is wonderful. Thank you very much. And I think some of you are introducing this program to other Masons, and I'm very pleased to hear that. Thank you. So maybe we're serving a purpose here, I think. On behalf of the production crew, who is me, and the studio crew, who is me, we're all grateful. But I need your advice, and address this as sort of a subtext for what we're going to talk about today, what we're going to go through here. I'm just trying to address things in a more frank and sincere manner. I'm not the person to gloss over the craft and think that, doing some of these superficial things in any way, anything superficial, is ever going to make a difference in a person's life in a serious way. And so it's like getting the earth under your fingernails. You begin to feel that you're apart, you're connected. It's like what I've often said, many people have said about being part of this great, huge country, is when you stand there, no matter where you're from, and you are awed by the magnificence of what's going on around us. And it just does something to us, makes the hair on our arms stand. It just, and we just breathe it in. That's when we know we're part of it. You're part of it. We're all part of something quite remarkable. That sounds a little bit cheesy to some, and we're going to get into that, make no mistake. Oh, we have to go back to Greece for that. I might even have to jump into some of the older cultures, but than that, Egypt and China, for some of the ideas that we are, subscribing to in Freemasonry today. All that pre-religiosity, I guess, but there's ideas that were brought forward, really great ideas, and virtue was one of them. So I began to think that we're part of something that's quite historical. So instead of just assuming that, I began to, let's ask ourselves together, why? Why is history so important to Freemasonry? Something that, I have to admit, a lot of us just take for granted. It's there. We had a history. We're old. But I don't think it's quite that simple. I really don't. If that were the case, if it was just that glib, we wouldn't exist today. I don't think we would have had the resonance to continue for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. We wouldn't be seeing, we wouldn't be trying to pull the film across from our eyes so that we can see more clearly what's going on around us. So here's a thought on this, huh? We can read history as if it's as the lives of others. So it's like I'm an interloper, or I'm sort of a very passive in this. I read about the history of your great 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 grandfather some other time. So it's not me. It really doesn't affect me emotionally. It's about that other fellow at that other time. But to somebody, that other time and that other place is personal. We can read history that way. We can also, so it's like saying history is not me. It's you or others. It's the soldier on the battleground. It's the washerwoman. It's the concubine to the Chinese emperor. It's the castrate in a Renaissance period. It's not me. We can also read history in terms of as if it is time link. Think about this. You're asking me, you're shuttled me to the door already, giving me my hat. Good grief. I play nice music for you. Shouldn't I buy a little bit of currency with you? You're a little impatient, aren't you, this day? History, we can read it as the lives of others or a time link. History of me, but a different parents in different time. Okay? That's like saying the history that we read today is of similarity. There's a connection between history and me, that I am in many ways part of that history, no matter if the history is of you or of somebody else. There are threads and connections that link me as a person, as a human, to the dilemma, that the issues have changed form, that the thinking has changed form, the language has changed form, that there is a contemporary nature. But qualifying all of that, we're not much different than we ever were. Now, you and I have to decide what it is that this means, that we're not all this different. The human condition, the human mind, human behavior is not much different. Well, we can get over our conceit about progress. Time isn't necessarily progress. My goodness, the physicists have equipped us with more information today. We have better science than we did before. But it's only better if we apply it, and it helps us to find answers. But doing that may take a long, long, long time. Remember the program on Higgs, and 30 years he waited until, with, you know, people sort of looking at him and mocking him maybe a little bit, until the boson was actually, quote, discovered, proof that the theory was valid. Well, in a way, the knowledge of the history may be just lingering there until it's discovered. It's not that it's new, it's just not being recognized for what it is. So that's another way of learning history. And remember, the question I'm trying to answer here is, why history? Why in Freemasonry? It can be read as the tarot. Think about it, the tarot card. There's a Masonic link if you care to examine that. If you don't, and that's a little too ooga booga for you, well, of course, you know, we'll put that away until there's only adults in the room. But I presume that I'm with good company right now. And Lord knows, I ask you for advice constantly, so, you know, I rely on you. The tarot is about the future. So we can read history. My goodness, how would we read history as an indication of the future? What does it tell us? Well, we can't in serious company subscribe to any kind of belief or superstition, can we? We are the positivist moderns. The positivism is that there has to be fact. The only validity comes from things that are factual. Well, how do we explain the unexplainable? how do we explain magic? You know, how do we explain illusion? Well, there you go. We know what happens inside our minds. We know a great deal about what we see around us is perception. We know today that just in a different way, that our thinking, our minds are far more sophisticated and far more active than we could ever imagine. So when we're talking about being in charge of ourselves, move over. We've got company. We may be on the bleacher, but we're not on that bleacher sitting there alone. If we're in charge of ourselves, we have a great many other mindsets sitting there with us that we are quite selective about using. Almost like that artistry where you see a palette. A palette of colors. You pull the colors together, you get perspective on it, and it blends into something that, you know, when you put your nose right up against the canvas, it looks like a bunch of dots, that pointillism. But if you step back, it's like it takes shape and form. So we can read history for what it tells us about the future. But we can only do that, I think, if we also embrace the sense that history is about us. This goes back to, this really begs formation of ideas by physicists that time is a singularity, I guess. Can I say that? Probably be jumped on by physicists, that the past, the present, and the future are one. The difference is the perspective. So why history? Because of what it reveals. And I think the similarity is as if our friend Peter was walking to the Delphi, and he had an appointment with the oracle, and the question that the oracle would give him an answer. And, you know, today we all have inherited know thyself. And we, as the tourist trade to the oracle increased, it became more sophisticated, and then there were, you know, vendors around, just like there is today. And they carve this over in stone, know thyself. Well, for a lot of us, the question is, you know, we want to think, well, we're sophisticated. I understand immediately what that means. But that's, I think, a bit boyish of us. As you get a little older, you don't have to be afraid to say you don't understand something. Not unless you're a fool. You have to pretend that you have an understanding of everything going on around you. That's pretty foolish. But none of us like to admit that there's something we don't understand. Well, that's not necessarily personality, boys. That's our brain. Our brain's doing that for us. Isn't that interesting? That's part of what's sitting on the bleachers with us. So the purpose of history is to reveal the nature of you and I. So the point, all right, that's maybe the why. Now, let's add a little bit of dimension to this. That's like we're putting together a nice meal, and, you know, one flavor doesn't really work. We need some other flavors here. What's the point? So the point, so that's like saying, I guess, in another way, what is Freemasonry? Well, the craft, I think, is the examination of psyche, self. Now, my goodness, I suspect that to do that within Freemasonry, I refer to that as the form. And the only defined form that I have as a reference point is from the Society of Jesus Christ. Most of us know that as the sort of the intelligentsia, the Jesuit. It's very, very rigorous screening to become part of that group. But the training, about 14 years? The training? No, that's wrong. Training is what the boss expects of me. I need to be trained to learn how to do a certain function. This is deeper. This is discovery and education. Now, education is what I need, what thrills me, what fulfills an appetite deeper inside each one of us to progress, to understand. That's education. The demon, the dragons that we fight are ignorance. The enlightenment is knowledge, the power. No, I would agree. Freemasonry is not a religion. Now, NSA, if you're picking this up out there, or what is it? What's the British version of that? It's not relevant here. The Freemasonry is not a religion, but there is, I think, if you will allow, a religion of the craft. We are not a religion, but there is a religion of the craft. And I think that that religion is virtue. It's virtue. That's not without its qualifiers. So on the bleachers of your life, there's qualifiers sitting around you now as well. And think of this within the cathedral of the mind. I think the cathedral was a metaphor for the human mind. Now, this is not to say that the Enlightenment and the Renaissance was a period of fools. But within those cathedrals, some, only some, will walk in the doors and will be worthy. Some will understand what they don't know. Others will not know what they don't know. Completely indifferent and not give a fig. To those that have figured it out. And as you sit there in your, what's the nice word? The quietude. I love that word. You sit in your quietude with a nice glass of Kool-Aid in your hand, your favorite flavor of Kool-Aid. Here it's a 15-year. Kool-Aid ages well, you know. It's so few of us that will step, few of us that become sort of the worthy, whatever the heck that is. Nobody selects the worthy. We do that for ourselves through our continued effort. When we appear to be enlightened, that worthy crowd, others, the demos, identify that. Others do. In the meantime, not you and I, because that would be arrogant. Look at me. Look what I've accomplished. It's more like the young artist who knows they're completely unproven. Nobody knows them. But they know that they can make knees weak, that they can play music that affects the soul. And there's no false modesty about it. They have that God-given talent. That's where I'm coming from. That's what I think appears as virtue. That's that moment. I don't know. What do you think? Just not the kind of conversation that I would jump into in Open Lodge, perhaps. But with you, I trust that this may have a little more relevance. A little more. A lot more. Stuff that you've been missing in Lodge, at least what a lot of people tell me. Don't get this in Lodge. But, you know, I think we have more in common than we do what distinguishes us. Color of our eyes and our height doesn't really make us that different. We're versions of the same thing. Samuel Johnson said, "The true measure of a man is how he treats somebody who can do him absolutely no good." Walk around and notice that. There are some fellows that will only associate with you when they can have some benefit. Interesting. Fascinating. You can tell whose company I prefer. A wise man will make haste to forgive because he knows the true value of time. It's important. And will not suffer it to pass away in unnecessary pain. So when you're not, somebody has wronged you, let it go as fast as you can and move on. Of the blessings set before you, make your choice and be content. That's like saying that, you know, that yearning, you're being somebody else. You're being in another place all the time when you're not satisfied. And those, you know, people that exploit that, well, the marketplace is full of people that are very persuasive. Make no mistake. People are persuasive. Oh, we'll just embellish that. You know, you have to have need. You have to have greed. And go after it. And good things happen. You just have to wish it to happen. Well, in a way, if you've got your senses in front of you, if you begin to appreciate it, you begin to sense that some of these ideas are quite valid. Of the blessings set before you, you make your choice. Be content with what you have. That's very, very powerful. Very powerful. You don't have to subscribe to it. You don't have to believe it. But you don't have to have all of this in your grasp today. No. Great works are performed not by strength, but by perseverance. Yeah. So we'll come back to it. Today, it's a good day. We're having it is. It's a remarkable day. This is a remarkable day in history, in the history of Britain. Yeah, the today in British history, the signing of the Magna Carta. My goodness, do you know that this is, de Montfort held the first English Parliament on the 20th of this week, 20th of January, 1265. What were the Graham clan up to in 1265? Well, I think we've had a little bit of problem with Edward the Hammer. Sort of ticked him off. He came over and killed as many of us as he could. But that was history, and the Bruce came and went. But the Magna Carta, very important to the likes of me, you, free people, 1215, you know, that was not then, that has still affected us to this day. English barons running around and getting together and forcing the king to agree to a series of articles. This is called the Provisions of Oxford. Interesting. If you're sitting at a keyboard or you're close by, or right, think about it. Provisions of Oxford. Go take a look. See what the boys were up to. The same kind of thing we'd be up to today. We see somebody that's doing something very strange with their office. It's disgusting and saddening, but we have processes in place. And now it's come to be expected that our processes are in place to allow us to handle some of these problems that come up. Remember, even with a virtuous world, there are some traps. There are some serious, serious problems. Anarchists love that because they can exploit them. There's limits to it. Very, very much. Very, very much. So we have to be careful. We do. There's no question about that. This was day 22nd of January, my wife's birthday. She's a little younger than this. In 1788, George Byron, Lord Byron, brother Byron, was born in London. This is a guy that wanted to tweak the nose of the establishment. You know, that set those unspoken boundaries. You know, this was a period of class struggle and distinction. You know, the heel of the power elite was on the throat of the poor man. On this date in January 22nd in 1901, old Queen Victoria died. She's at 81 years old, seen a heck of a lot during her period in office. Her son went on to be the next king, Edward VII. And her grandson went on to be Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany. Interesting woman. And then we have lots of material and information about battles and domination and so-called victories and stuff like that. This is a 20 in here in Canada. Yay, Canada. January 26th, Madame de Poutrincourt left Dieppe with Jesuits, two Jesuits, and she was the first titled lady, the first Jesuits in Canada, Dieppe, France. Came from Dieppe, France here. And in January 1612, Gilbert du Tay arrived at Port Royal with a relief ship. And he was a Jesuit. They figured they needed people that had their heads on and their wits about them to come over. Things now, we know that that didn't always work out well, and we've re-examined the motives of all of that. That was then. It wouldn't necessarily happen like that today, would it? In 1666, it was the Second Anglo-Dutch War. The war broke out between England and the United Provinces of the Netherlands. You know, there was sort of very, very interesting mix of politics and merchant power. So Netherlands, Denmark, and France. And then in the 1700, I won't keep, I'll just let you figure out that it was January 26th, the Great Cascadia Earthquake. And they guess this is probably a quality 9, and it occurred at 9 p.m. this day. And written records from Japan indicate that the Washington State and B.C. coastal areas suffered a massive tsunami. And in 1776, the American Revolution broke out, and a fellow named Eustace Cartier de la Binière, he was a Canadian priest, he was appointed chaplain to serve Canadians who joined the American invading force. U.S. Congress then ratified his appointment on the 12th of August, 1776. And the U.S. Army's first chaplain is a French-Canadian. Ba-da-da! Little drum roll, please. Did you know? Well, now you do. 1836, John Colborne assumed his new position as Commander-in-Chief of British Forces in British North America. He kept house in Montreal, huh? 1870, the Red River Rebellion. This is the second Red River Convention met in Winnipeg. So not that long ago. Huh? Rail, in 1888, the Charter of Columbia and Kootenai Rail and Transportation Company was canceled. 1887, John A. MacDonald, he was appointed Grand Senior Warden, if I'm not mistaken. He won a majority of votes in Nova Scotia. And Charles Tupper resigned as Canadian High Commissioner in London to return and run for election. And he was reelected in Nova Scotia. Thank goodness, huh? Oh, dear. Now, in January 26, 1913, pro hockey teams returned to the 7-man team from 6-men here in Canada. There you go. And in 1924... Parliament approved the 1921 version of the Red Ensign as Canada's official flag for government buildings at home and abroad until the Maple Leaf was adopted. The Order in Council mandates its use in Canadian government buildings outside Canada. It was first officially allowed use of the ensign with the arms of the four founding provinces and has been unofficially used for many, many, many years. So when you take a look at that, you see that little crest? That's what's contained in it. Four original founding provinces. That's a bit cool, I think. So enough of that. This day, God bless her. I only had a chance. I think I met her once at my graduation. She was the at the university. Jean Sauvé. She died in hospital. She was quite a wonderful woman. She was served as Canada's first woman Governor General and the first female Speaker of the House and Commons. She was definitive, just remarkable. I'll leave that at that. So that's a bit about this day in Canadian history. Let's plunge in to so many ideas. Where do we go next? My goodness. A little bit about the Renaissance period and Freemasonry. You up to that today? We are often explained. It's often explained that we're part of that the Renaissance period. But just for the sake of a refresher, this came after what was the ancient era in the 3000 to 400 AD. And then it came after the Middle Ages, and that was 400 AD to 1400 AD, 13th century. And we can get over the, it was Petrarch that said that they called the medieval age the Dark Ages. And the only reason he brought that up was that to him, it seemed that the period was human achievement had really gone into the dumper when you compared it to the ancient Greeks and Romans. That's why he called it the Dark Ages. It's like, Greeks and Romans were really producing a lot of ideas and developing a lot of ideas. And this guy, rightly or wrong, he said, hey, what's been going on lately? Not a whole lot. It's almost like the light has gone off. And that's where that notion of the Dark Ages comes from. Dangling. Pardon my grammar here. The Renaissance, though, was 1400 to 1600. This is when we found a rebirth in the interest of ancient Greek and Roman culture. And that period, if you're wondering, between the period of the Greek and Roman culture, well, a lot of that information would have been lost had not the Islam translated the Greek and Latin and studied it at a period when no other culture, no other civilization was doing that. And here, of course, that was a period of scientific discovery. After what was it about 645, when the Islam started to grow, I think. I'm saying that very clumsily, but if not for the East studying and then bringing that forward, writing and telling us about it, a lot of that would have been lost. It's not magical. Today we have to root through garbage and dirt underneath the grease and then begin to make calculated guesses by our best scholars to tell us what was going on. Well, thankfully, this bright group of Arab scientists and scholars conveyed the information. So the Renaissance was where there was that rebirth. It's like, oh, what was going on? Let's take a look at where we came from. What's the roots? And there was a period of economic prosperity, always where you if people are throwing things at you, trying to kill you, you don't exactly have time to crack a book, do you? So especially in Italy and Northern Europe, things are going along really well. If you're an art aficionado, and I think some of you are, take a look at the Italian Renaissance, the Northern Renaissance. And there's a lot revealed in through art that if we look at it, you understand a little bit about the history. It's like we begin to nod, now I understand. The Greeks, of course, were looking for the perfection of the human form, in the human form. So we see this. What do we see? We see these sculpture that is so lifelike. It's like life is in that stone, isn't it? Yeah. Everything changed. The way we looked at the world began to be called humanism. And a very simple version of that, it's sort of a renewed value of human knowledge and experience of the world, as opposed to focusing largely on the heavenly realm. So remember, up to then, you know, anything important, we look to the heavenly realm for an explanation. Humanism is when we looked at where the value of human knowledge began to be recognized, became a currency, I think, and the experience of this world using ancient Greek and Roman literature and art as the model. Not perfect, but not bad. And this changed a lot. Invention and adoption of the printing press happened during this period. Therefore, wide availability of books and literacy rates in Europe just increased. You give books to people that you've suppressed in ignorance for a long time, they're going to read them, and they're going to talk about them. They're going to scratch their head and say, what does this mean? Exactly the kind of thing where you and I are doing right here. Readers were empowered, and we can trace the origin of our own information revolution, yippee, to the 15th century. So when you're sitting there, you hear some old sea dog say, oh, I can't follow all of this. This is all terrible. Well, but 15th century, what are you going to do? Break the printing press? Well, people were trying to do that. Isn't it a little late to be whining about it? Suck it up, buttercup. Get on with it. This didn't start like, Apple started it. Well, no. No. You know, it's like what started the development of the car? The wheel? Well, without the wheel, we wouldn't exactly have. You get it? 15th century Germany and Gutenberg's first printing press. There. So reach your hand back in your history and say, I've got one hand and shaking with Gutenberg and the other hand with Steve Jobs. There you go. There. That's more accurate. 1517, Martin Luther, he was a bit of a feisty little shit. So here he goes and he challenges the Pope. And I say, well, why are you guys living like that? That's just not right. That's not nothing to do with faith. All these people are poor and they're hungry, and you guys are living the lavish. You're living the life. So he went right after them. And, of course, Protestant Reformation, all that kind of stuff. Do that reading yourself. Make your own conclusions out of it. But the printing press helped spread his work. Now, this is the key thing, I think. Take a little takeaway. I like that. Takeaway message. The work, asserting the authority of individual conscience. That idea, this isn't right. That comes not from the heavenly realm. That comes from a man, a person, a mind. So Luther was handing out these pamphlets, thanks to the printing press. And it was increasingly possible for people to read the Bible in the language that they spoke. Fabulous. The Reformation laid the foundation for that value. Modern culture places on the individual. And it continues today. So this wasn't the cult or the age of the individual. It wasn't in the 60s. Unless that's all the history that you know, and you begin to think that all of this was not part of things that were begun some time ago. 16th century stuff, 1517. The Renaissance. I would think that we can begin to sort of feel amazed about the impact, the influence of the Renaissance period on the thinkers that were developing notions of Freemasonry that predated 1717. That was our bureaucracy. But I think we look better at the ideas, the philosophy, morality, where that began to be sussed out was at this. We needed to reevaluate the individual, the individual as an appendage to the heavenly realm, or the individual as the most important aspect. Well, go and read Descartes, go and read Spinoza, go and take a look, and we begin to see that these ideas that you and I have inherited, they never taught us this stuff in school, did they? Because we wouldn't have had context. You and I have a life lived. Some of us more than others. We're still learning. So now let's fit Freemasonry into this period, Renaissance period and Freemasonry. So then we're going to get into some really interesting ideas because we had to have scholars. A lot of these ideas were happening at different places in the globe, but some of the boys had to go and sort it out. Well, we had to have a bit of time and inclination, some resources to go and do it. But then what we brought back to the discussion added to those entities sitting on the bleachers with you and me. It brought back new information that changed the way we thought. Oh, I used to think that the world was flat. Now you're telling me that, you know, that there is an arc to the horizon. Well, let me rethink that claim. All right, the world is not that flat. Now, you could imagine there would be some wag that says, I'm always right, and of course the world is flat. But life went on. Ideas went on. And we began to understand fact. Huh? Positivism. Not without its caveats. So let's talk. Do you mind if we talk? Let's talk a little bit about, this is stuff that came from an article called the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. It was printed back in 1972. And I know that's before some of you were born. Come on. Some of you still have habits that you developed in 1972. Some of you can tell me your golf scores from 1972, for goodness sakes. Or what you were... I won't get into all those embarrassing things that you won't admit in public. So we're talking about, this is really a period of what's called Neoplatonism. You know, this idea that, it saddens me, and I want to be really honest with you about this. When a fellow says, you know, I don't think, you know, we're going to talk about things philosophical. Oh, well, I don't think I'm smart enough to follow that. You know, that's for those intelligent people. That really saddens me. So that means, for me, the work is to make this discussion broader and make it palatable for everybody. And I guess maybe it's my experience in life that allows me to do that, because I saw people that I grew up with, people that influenced me, my family. You know, who think didn't have a lot in Prince Edward Island. But what we knew was the quality and the caliber of a man. That's what you were taught. When we were little children, these are the lessons that we were taught. And you were taught how to think and how to appreciate what was told to you. You didn't sit there idly and not pay attention. You paid attention because a lot of things were only said once. And if you weren't bright enough to pick them up, then you weren't bright. Now what do we do? Good grief, we're still chasing grown men around, pleading with them to learn. It doesn't work that way. That ship has sailed. Freemasonry needs to really up its game a bit. Boy. So the discussion is really of things that we all understand. It's just that there's some of the things we can see evidence of it, but there's a lot of things that go on in our minds that we understand that we really can't see with the eye. But we know we can't see love between a young man and a young woman, but we know it's there. We can't see it, but we know it's there. So philosophy helps us to understand things that we can't necessarily see, but we understand to be, and that we hold them in common. Now, is this a free-for-all where everybody can make up their own philosophy? Well, you start off that way, of course, but eventually we refine it. It's like a whetstone, you know, when you're sharpening the edge of a knife. I often think that my ashlar would have been used as though a whetstone. You know, polishing it. Well, do you ever ask yourself what kind of polish and what for? Was it just to make the surfaces nice and smooth and square? Well, my whetstone had to have a practical application. My stone, my ashlar, if I'm taking from crude, had to have some application. It had to be practical. Like, what for? Well, if it's to sharpen the edge of something, now I have a sharper tool that I can use. So that whetstone is absolutely essential. Not in a childish kind of a way. It is absolutely essential to the use of the tools. Well, if you don't know how to use a sharp tool, it's no need, then I guess you're just sharp and you're just polishing the stone for the sake of polishing the stone. Good luck to you. Different way of thinking about the ashlar, right? What was it for? How did you use it? How did you, your personality, your character, how did you think about how would you have used that? Maybe you would use it similar to sharpen tools. That's not a bad thing. Neoplatonism, though, is a sort of the philosophical and religious system, and this is mainly composed of a mix of Platonic ideas and Egyptian and Asiatic mysticism. Now, Freemasonry is full of the indications, eh? Full of it. And it's perhaps best represented by three guys, who always threes, eh? Plotinus, Porphyry, and Proclus. And it doesn't really matter. Permeated. This was pretty popular back in Renaissance thinking. You know? And it blurred distinctions between matter and spirit. There we go. This is going to cause us no end of grief. How can I actually exist as a spiritual entity? Did I say that out loud? It was, of course, fundamentally pantheistic. The whole of the cosmos was seen as an entity, and special attributes were accorded to symbols, numbers, colors, and letters. Everything merged with the divine. Now, don't be daft in thinking that we were not superstitious at this time. We were massively superstitious as cultures and civilizations, and that went into the 18th, 19th, 21st century. Don't think that we've escaped that. We have to be aware of it. How much of what governs our thinking or influence us is because of superstition. Well, it was bigger here because we were laying it out there. So colors, numbers, letters, all the things, I guess. You know, you want to study the history of Ouija, the history of tarot, you know, take a look. Indeed, harnessing of forces for the benefit of mankind was the aim of the occultists, the alchemists, the astrologers and magicians. It wasn't like you're going to take some sinister power and control the planet. These were powers that we're hoping to discover for the benefit of all of us, insight and understanding. So when we think about the alchemists and astrologers, like, what were they trying to do? Well, it wasn't just creepy, moldy laboratories. You know, something that we can conjure up because it was, portrayed on black and white television in the 40s and the 50s. Get that image out of your head. That was just done to sell something. That was a problem. Well, it was. It was a dumbed down, a very simplistic version of something that was enormously sophisticated. So we had the search for esoteric knowledge came on through alchemy. And became an obsession in the 16th and 17th centuries, well before the Newtonian physicists paid much attention to such notions. You know, there was something valid, in the alchemist's art. In this connection, the materialistic ideas born of rationalism had been unfair to the age of alchemists. These are the boys that were looking for the philosopher's stone. And was more striving for some form of moral and spiritual rebirth than a cheap way of making money in the literal sense. Alchemy as metaphor, eh? The alchemist desired to find a reality behind the physical world and strove to understand and control forces of nature to give mankind powers beyond what he could imagine. But the Renaissance alchemist sought a perfection of the spirit, a union with the divine in the universe, mind-body, still going on to this day, and a godlike state of pure, revealed knowledge. Pure and revealed. Something that is unchallengeable, sort of like the purity of geometry. You know, when they say that the 90 degree, the mathematics behind that, there's a truth in that. There's a validity in that. That's what's exciting about geometry. And we know that we've in the 21st century, 20th century, we eclipsed Euclidean geometry. There's something, a different form of geometry has been added to the bleachers for us. So poetry of the period is frequently ecstatic and deeply concerned with the attainment of some unspoiled and spiritual plane of blinding character. Things that poetry talks about, things that are beyond experience. You know, it's like let your mind wander and write down what you're discovering. Till the sea itself flowereth in your veins. Never going to happen, yeah? But think about it. Till you are clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars and perceive yourself to be the sole heir of the whole world. And more than so, because men are in it who are everyone's sole heirs, as well as you. You know that, what I was talking about earlier, that fusion, that connection, that link. You're linking time. Now, can you see that? Can you experience that in your mind? Experience it in the mind. There's an ecstatic quality, you know, that sort of over-the-top identification in the description of corn as the immortal wheat that should never be reaped. This is from a Thomas Traherne from 1637. He was born in 1637, and he only lived a short period of time. Yeah, I think he was in his 40s when he died. Take a look at Thomas Traherne, T-R-A-H-E-R-N-E. So he talks about the corn as immortal wheat. I keep thinking semantically that, you know, we've, Freemasonry sort of changed ears of corn for corns of, you know, what the true meaning of the word was back in the day, which should never be reaped nor ever, was ever sown, immortal wheat. And his thought that it stood for from everlasting to everlasting, the immortal wheat. And do we see that on the district deputy's collar? Yeah, we do. How many of them? Let's help them. It's not like, oh, gee, they've got it. They have to understand it. My goodness. Well, don't ever hand a poor man a talisman, because handing it to him, he's supposed to understand everything about it. Come on now, that's just not fair. Such notions are foreign to the more prosaic world of modern physics, born to Newtonian discoveries in an age obsessed with measurement. Oh, by man, we are that. Ignoring the immeasurable as though by it did not exist because it cannot be measured. But they are not foreign to the sensibilities of Greco-Roman world. So, a little bit of spice to the conversation, to the meal that we're enjoying today. Yeah, absolutely. This isn't a topic, and getting into the, we'll just leave it there, because the Masonic period and Freemasonry in it isn't something that you want to sit down and gorge. I don't think that does it justice. I don't think it's the way to go about learning it. So just a little taste. That's interesting. And it may, for some of us, like it is for me, it's an acquired taste. It's like I like a little bit of it. Sort of like, a really good goat cheese. The first time, it's like, what in the world did you do to my cheddar? But, you know, you put a little bit of something else with a nice glass of Merlot with it, and then all of a sudden it does something, and you have it handed to you as a dessert after a lovely meal and slice very thin. You know, all of a sudden you can begin to appreciate it differently. Similarly with this material. So just settle in a little bit and think about that. That's that will give, and remember, the people around you, because you have some of this knowledge, it is esoteric. You know, it's not obvious to everybody is what I'm saying. Doesn't mean everybody that doesn't have it is stupid. It doesn't. There are so many different paths to follow. So let's be generous of spirit, because we are trying, after all, to achieve some level of virtue. And our generosity, oh my, our charity knows no bounds there. See, these things come back to haunt us. They do. Over and over and over again. This is a... What do we do today? Are we close to enlightenment? Old is new again? So, you know, it was the topic that I was thinking about when I pulled this together. So, and I just, you know, wrote down some of these ideas. And again, help me here. I'm woefully out of it. What does this say to you? What, you know, what does this mean? Normally, we don't think of ourselves in philosophical terms, nor do we tend to use history as reference points. We don't. The sciences and arts, bastardized by generations of feeble educational aspirations, have reached fruition. The experiment of democracy has shown major flaws, polarizing haves and have-nots. It isn't social development that we talk about in the cafes, but the price of doing so. In Rome, expressions of hubris was an act of criminal. It was a criminal act, hubris, where you were bragging about what you had, where you were embellishing the fact that you beat somebody. This is a criminal act. Oh, yeah. So let me drive my, you know, let me have my conspicuous display of wealth, because I have a right to that, because, you know, I'm a free person and I can speak freely. Well, not so. Not if you're inclined to a virtuous life. It's wrong-minded. If you're doing it, you should be ashamed. There you go. So in Rome, you could get killed for doing that. Today, intoxicated by acquisition, men brag of success in an unbalanced marketplace. Oh, the marketplace will set the rules. So that the fact that I have access that is far beyond what the average visitor to the marketplace has is of no consequence to me. It is what it is. The men brag about that. So right now we're in the middle of something that's very interesting. These experiments, this experiment of capitalism, has shown some potholes. And now we have to fill them. And we know we collectively have to fill them. And we know that that's not going to be done with a smile on our face. No, we can't do any of that. We can't be forward thinking. We have to do it. We have to muck it out. We have to probably cause a lot of pain before we can achieve that. After we do that, then it's like, oh, well, there. We've caused enough damage. We've paid the price of damage and the insult and the stain to the human conscience again. Maybe we've dropped some weapon, although I think I hope we've reached a point where we understand that there's no honor in that. None. Let history guide us through that. So here we have, and I refer to it as an intoxication. We're intoxicated by acquisition. Men brag of success in an unbalanced marketplace. Time is disguised as history. We disguise it with history. Time is what it is. Extracts the consequences of our conceits. Time takes that out. History is a natural judge. Always harsh. No appeal process. We would be wrong to think tolerance of hubris will be unpunished. The bragging, the young teenage star that wants to take $500,000 car and carry on through the streets and brag about it. Or the despot or the oligarch. Oh, I don't think it's possible to escape the consequence. Nobody has so far. No one lies for us. You know, collectively, we are, there's an unblemished, unvarnished truth. No one lies. We can make up the stories to try and convince ourselves. Each one of us does that for ourselves. We lie for ourselves. We have much to learn from great cultures. To date, there have been only two, let me say, Greece and Rome. Maybe I will qualify that and say I'm going to take a look at Egypt and China. Let me come back to that. Let me be generous with me and say maybe there's two others. Probably is. In a world split between those who know learning means survival, and those who treat learning as a burden. The Western world repeats what has not been learned. Mistakes of the past haunt the lost generations. When I began to think that way, it was really startling for me. It made me stop. I had come to a realization. Do you know how many people around us are eager to learn? Because it is for them survival, just like it was for you and I. And yet, we look around and it's almost painful to see how many people feel that it's a burden. And we'll find an excuse. That's all they're doing is finding an excuse. I have some disability. Well, if that's what limits you. And I say that with complete resentment to some blind guy that's climbed Mount Everest and he's out there golfing and he's kicking the pants off the likes of me. Doesn't he know he's not supposed to be able to do it? Well, it's not the disabilities that stop a fella. It's a fella that stops a fella. If that's what it takes to defeat him, fine. You know, the color of your hair, the color of your eyes, or your stature, if that's what it takes, fine. You've discovered your conceit. But these guys, these men and women are saying, that's all you got? You know, I'm going to ski at the Olympics. Well, buddy, you only have one leg. Well, yeah, but I'm really good at ski. See, me, full-bodied, I'm supposed to, at least somebody claims I have my wits about me. What have I got to complain about? Makes me seem ridiculous. Makes the speaker seem childish every single time. Eh. Well, this is a mistake. So what we don't learn, it's a burden. You know, our education is a burden. Oh, I'm not here. I'm there to have a good time. Give me a beer and a hot dog. Well, I'm not going to say that that's a bad thing, but it's ridiculous. It doesn't have. You can do that anywhere. You do that, in a, you know, at a truck diner, and you know, that's not. Yeah, it's not the atmosphere where you sit down and have conversation. So we make these mistakes, trivializing these things. What will turn this tide? Are men receptive to thinking? You're receptive. You're sponge-like, you know. You've got to just draw it in and challenge it for yourself. This part makes sense. This part doesn't. Men who study to control the desire. This will make men. Men who will be persecuted for harboring beliefs of common purpose. Oh, make no mistake. You're gonna take some stick for this. You know, if you start thinking about the greater good, Neil Young, how dare, he's a celebrity, how dare he talk about what we've done over there? Oh, how dare he? That's just, let's get rid of him. So, of course, similarly, if you take this step, common purpose, ask yourself if the old school principles, boarding school rules of conduct, and passive encouragement of learning are the tools of change. Are they? Do you see brethren hungry to be a successful apprentice capable of stepping into the shoes of great thinkers? That's what you see? Don't tell me. If not the first and second estate, who has a chance that is not despotic of improving the world? The first and second estate can't do it. Ethics are different when your child is starving. Your sense of purpose is different. Maybe an honest man becomes a thief if it means helping his child to eat that day. It's grim, isn't it? Now ask the question. Now, challenge you. Yeah, challenge me. Does Freemasonry have purpose in the 21st century? Obviously. But I think we really need to talk, don't you? What, when I wrote that, what was I on? guess, that sense that Freemasonry is important, that sense that I don't subscribe to the idea that there's the past is better than the future for us. It's all one. There is no separation. There is no separation. No. You are the embodiment, the epitome of Freemasonry. As you make it. There's the challenge. Unpleasant as hell, isn't it? Let's try and deal that one away. Let's try and give that notion to somebody else. Now, context. Now it's easy. If the context is all about the literal and concrete, we really don't get into the esoteric. So if you've been listening, all this other stuff, I think it makes sense. It's been in the mind. Ideas, that's what's known as the esoteric side of life as a Freemason. Yeah. And at some point, you need to stop explaining that. That's like, get over it. It's like trying to explain to somebody, every time I see you, well, we want you to take a bath. And by the way, I'm going to tell you about the properties of water. Well, after a while, take the damn bath. I don't want to get into this anymore. Esoteric, you know what it is. You've moved on. If you don't, go and get a dictionary. Find out for yourself until you satisfy yourself. In the meantime, there's all these other really interesting conversations going on. Try and get it your head around. I can't. Part of what I'm having difficulty getting my head around, thank you, Stephen Hawking, is this sense that I exist past, present, and future all in the same moment. So I have these visual images, these graphic illustrations of time bending. Yeah, and then I'm trying to figure out mass and energy, right? Mass is energy. E equals mc squared. There it goes. So now we can all take our little break, I guess. Can we do that? You want to take a little break? You can put this on pause. Fire me. I know the lineup to get your price of your ticket and admission is getting long. It's over here. I'll get around to all of you in just a second. Man, I like you guys. It's like you indulge me. It's wonderful. Thanks. You indulge in the ideas that I think we all hold in common. I know I'm as derivative as the next person. And just pay attention. Just pay attention. Life goes on. And at the end of this, there's not going to be any fatalities. I could swear to that. But get into something. We'll get into something let's have a little bit of talk about simpler stuff to sort of pull ourselves out of this. If you need to fill your Kool-Aid glass again, by all means, this is a good thing. Can we talk about a modern Masonic lodge? Yeah, it's okay. Modern. You. And notion that this was not always the case, is a rectangular room with seating around the perimeter. The ceremonies of the lodge take place in the center of the room so everybody has a good view. Oh, there you go. Now, a good view. So how many of us, we see guys sit in the farthest corner from the east in the back row, obscure, so they're not there. Now that tells us about their thinking and connection with the craft, doesn't it? Also, perhaps, if it's as painful to hear to see the fellow that always sits front and center who wants us to hear his oratory skills that aren't that good, or doesn't realize that by dominating the conversation at every lodge meeting, he's pushing the timid into the back row. There you go. A little awareness. So, buddy, shh, don't be chattering away all the time. And don't be going and telling the guy that sits in the back row what you think he needs to do. The hell with you. Who made you God? when that guy feels comfortable, he'll step forward. Maybe, and I pray, maybe he is an introvert, a contemplative fellow, and he's there to sit and listen. Let him be. I'm not doing anything wrong. You can't handle it. Well, that's your problem. Let him be. Don't be making an assumption because you're a chatterbox and this is the way you learn, that this is the way everybody has to learn. Hell no. I think we get into these types of strides on an individual, in the individual mind. And if we're fortunate, you have a couple of people that you trust that you can engage, that you can talk on a different level. And even if you're more fortunate, you find that there's somebody that can take you along a path that you knew was there, but you couldn't really define. It's like they're saying, these mentors are saying, it's okay. It's okay. You can be a spiritual being. You can speculate. You can be esoteric. You can be the alchemist. You can probe legitimately. Nobody's going to mock you here. Out there where things aren't understood, you have to be cautious. Don't be presumptuous. Now, we know that lodge rooms are usually oriented east and west. Ancient temples were constructed this way to be aligned with the east-west path of the sun. Even if a Masonic building actually faces north and south, when you walk in, you're symbolically facing the east. Goes without saying it. There is an altar where the Bible or other holy book sacred to that lodge members is open. This book is referred to as the Volume of the Sacred Law. Three candles are placed in a triangular position, okay, next to or surrounding the altar to illuminate the Volume of Sacred Law. Officers have chairs in different positions around. And you know how many people you only hear, I'm going through the chairs. They don't know that the chair is an office of the lodge. Senior warden is in the west on a platform of two steps, and the junior warden's in the south. And this is apparently to symbolize the progression of life, youth, manhood, and age. Well, we'll go along with that definition for now, won't we? I'm not exactly thinking it's that, but there are two tall pillars with globes at the top, patterned after two bronze columns that were prominent architectural features of Solomon's temple. I always think these are marvelous, marvelous. And you notice when they're in lodges where you're in a lodge where they don't exist, like the lodge is incomplete. And then you get some silly bugger saying it's always been that way. We can't have that. Makes you laugh. Right? They're usually on either side of the senior warden and sometimes next to a doorway leading into the lodge, so you can pass between. Very symbolic. Up in Ottawa, if you get a chance to visit the Masonic Center up there, fabulous lodge room with massive, massive pillars that really do have a message. When you see them, it's like, this is something very interesting going on. And we even have the illuminated G suspended over the master's chair in the east or over the altar. Yeah. And it's, you know, if you ask, what does it represent? In geometry, yeah. The purity of geometry. And a little looser is to say it represents the great creator of all it is. The secret knowledge. That was the secret knowledge, the geometry, separated the stonemasons from others. So there we have a little bit of it. We'll come back to that again, I suspect, I hope. Yeah, that would be nice. I don't want to tie you up a whole lot today. Thanks for joining me. I'm going to wind this down. Next time we may get into some material on living the enlightenment. This is an interesting book by Margaret C. Jacob. We need to talk about these constitutional societies. You know, we have a constitution. Well, there's a study out there. That comes as a surprise, isn't it? about the early days of the Masonic fraternity on the continent, who were plagued with disputes engendered largely by ecclesiastical authorities. Protestant was, as was the case of Nijmegen and Catholic. Now, Nijmegen, Nijmegen, and Catholic. So really, they really went after the craft and Catholics and the Nijmegen. But controversy was never solely the work of anti-Masonic publicists external to the lodge. The task of establishing these new constitutionally governed societies was brought about with a crisis over legitimacy and authority, and not least over national identity as the fraternity spread far and wide from the London Grand Lodge. The records of Dutch Freemasonry once again richly illustrate this phenomenon. They permit us to watch the tensions and uncertainties of the fraternal participants in this new and unique form of social and political behavior. As one example, we shall focus on the disagreements that arose between the most historically important Dutch lodge located in Amsterdam and called Le Bien Ami, good friend, and the National Grand Lodge in The Hague. Woven into their disputes were issues about the nature of true Masonic government, and more precisely about the validity of or legitimacy of the Masonic Constitution. Amid these disputes, we can also witness some of the first efforts made on the continent, if only in a private voluntary setting, to exercise a form of self-government. Within the confines of private sociability, the abstractions found in some of the favorite texts of the Enlightenment, from Locke through Montesquieu, and not least Voltaire, who praised all things English, may take on for us a more textured meaning. One lived as well as read. So we'll get into that. Is that all right? Creating constitutional societies. So we'll talk about both in Britain and the continent, you know, the development of new lodges. We'll get into that next week. In the meantime, I hope you're enjoying everything that's going on and that you'll I'll play out with a little bit of music, a little bit of, you know, ooga booga, boyish kind of mystery music, and maybe a little bit of Herbie Hancock, just because I hope you're doing well. Watch out for each other and commit random acts of Masonic kindness. Remember, we're going to try and reinstate the sense of cool to Freemasonry. Not like it's a hairstyle or a fashionable shirt. But when we walk into a room, we know we're in the room of men that have done a bit of thinking. It's always comfortable. It's always a pleasure. See you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.